Innovation has always fueled economies because new technologies generally create new businesses. But most of today's innovators emerge from a very specific demographic.
They tend to be men, white, from rich families. In fact, if you are from a family in the top 1% of the income distribution, it's 10 times more likely that you will one day get a patent compared to someone who comes from a family below the median of the income distribution. I am Xavier Jaravel. I am a professor of economics at the London School of Economics, doing research on innovation, inflation, inequality, and other topics.
Jaravel's research examines how this innovation elitism holds our economies back and how diversifying the pool of innovators could share the benefits more broadly.
So we would have more product variety for women. We would have more product variety for low-income people as well. And so then you also have this democratizing force downstream for the employees and the customers of the firm.
Xavier Jaravel's article on innovation appears in the March edition of Finance and Development magazine. Journalist Rhoda Metcalf sat down with him to talk about his research.
So in your work, you talk a lot about this idea of lost Einsteins and lost Marie Curies. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Right, so it's really a simple idea. It's that we massively underuse talent that could be devoted to advancing innovation and science. So many people would have the drive, the talent to work on innovation as entrepreneurs, as patent inventors, as engineers. Right. But they don't do it for a variety of reasons. And from recent research, we see that really the lost talent is massive, both nationally within countries like the US, UK, mm-hmm. France, Nordic countries, but also internationally with even more lost talent from the South.
Are there economic consequences to this innovation loss?
So there are indeed very large economic consequences. And my main message is that what we lose here in terms of GDP is much bigger than probably anything else you've seen when you've thought about innovation policy. We probably lose about 1 percentage point of economic growth every year.
Okay.
Because of the underused talent. So that means we could grow at 3% a year instead of 2% a year.
Okay. One aspect of this issue that I think is particularly interesting is the idea that if innovation was more diverse, was occurring in a more varied population, that it would also change the kind of innovations that emerge.
That's right. That's what we've seen. And by kinds of innovations, we mean the kinds of products that people create.
Right.
And so this has, you know, many consequences, and there are, you know, different historical examples. One I like that's a bit tragic, but that's mm-hmm. telling, is the inventor of the reading system for the blind, Braille.
Braille.
Yeah. So it was Louis Braille was a French, a young French child, actually, when he lost his eyesight in an accident in his father's office. He was, mm-hmm. He was only 3 years old. And then later he worked on this, refined an existing system. And so we see that it's a tragic example of someone encountering a problem in their lives and then solving it to some extent. And we see many other examples of this in modern data as well.
So what you're talking about is somebody who is essentially disabled, and because they understand this disability, they innovate for other disabled people.
Right. And then there would be other examples where it's just problems that you encountered in your life that you feel well equipped to solve or intrinsically motivated to solve.
Okay.
So it turns out that women are much more likely to be intrinsically motivated to work on the green transition.
So environmental issues.
Environmental issues. It's women are 3 times more likely than they work on these questions compared to men. It's also true for health issues. And so changing the set of people who are active as engineers, scientists, entrepreneurs would also change the types of products and the types of societal goals we're trying to achieve by innovating.
And part of your research has looked at how women are much less likely to innovate than men are. I mean, how much less likely?
This changes a bit over time. So in the 1950s, if you look at patent data, you have about something like 7% of patent inventors are women.
Right.
In 2014, you look at everyone in the economy, about 12% of these patents are for women.
In the whole world, or?
In the US, that's for the US. Mm-hmm. And you also have huge gaps by parent income, by race, and by geography.
So just going back to women for a moment, yeah. I think in the paper, there's some kind of statistic around how much productivity would be boosted if women were inventing at the same rate as men.
Right, exactly. So the number we arrive at is something that you alluded to earlier. It's an increase of over 1 percentage point in growth a year. So in our model, baseline, we have 2% productivity growth rate annually. Mm-hmm. And that's with only 12% of women among innovators. And then when you bring that number to 50%, so really mm-hmm. reaching parity, then you increase the growth rates now from 2% to 3.4% a year. So it's a plus 1.4 percentage point per year, which is a huge effect. It's also not easy, right, to get to that level of parity.
Sure.
You might think, that seems maybe too large. So we have a variety of statistical analysis in the paper that look at different types of technologies where historically women have become a larger part of the workforce of innovators. For example, in chemistry, you have more representation of women. And you, in fact, see that in these fields, it has indeed increased the overall flows of innovation over time. And so it's not like women just replace men one for one. It seems more like there is really this expansion. And part of it might be that you bring in some very, very talented women, the lost Marie Curies. And then, when people start creating new ideas, new innovations, that also leads others to build on these other innovations.
That's interesting. Just want to go back a little bit and talk about what holds back the emergence of innovators, especially in lower income populations, because this is not just an economic barrier, is it? It's not just because you can't afford to go to university. There's a lot more involved than that, right?
Yeah, so we think there's a range of factors, but financial incentives, financial constraints, that's not the only thing. And one way to see it is to look at studies of countries like Finland, where the education system is free. And so there should be no barriers. And indeed, there are no financial barriers. And yet you see the exact same relationship as in the United States between parent income and the probability of going to a STEM field, the probability of creating a firm, the probability of being a patent inventor.
So the richer kids, if you come from a richer family, you're much more likely to become an inventor.
Much more likely. In fact, for inventors, for instance, if you are from a family in the top 1% of the income distribution, it's 10 times more likely that you will one day get a patent compared to someone who comes from a family below the median of the income distribution. So huge differences. And we think a lot of that is tied with the future that people envision for themselves, right, the aspirations that they have created for themselves, which come from the people they've interacted with throughout their lives.
If my father could do it, then I can do it too.
Exactly.
As opposed to nobody in my family has ever done that before.
Exactly. And so we see this type of role model effects within the family, at a broader level within neighborhoods. We see also the role of peers at school. And so all of that then can be very important for finding policy approaches to counteract these things and help people discover different occupations, basically imagine different futures for themselves. And I think the good news is that in some cases they can change because public policies try to address these very issues. And so there's encouraging randomized experiments where we introduce role models in schools.
Okay.
And that drastically changes the types of education that people then decide to pursue.
So where have those kinds of projects occurred? I mean, where have you seen that?
So we've seen that in the US and also in France. So the French case, for instance, looks at high school students.
Right.
And so there was this interesting experiment where female scientists were brought to randomly selected classes to visit. And so they saw a range of high school students, and they talked about their lives, their education, their job, and they were working in data analytics or product creation, different sorts of things.
Right.
A very short intervention, about 1 hour. And it turns out that this had a massive impact on the choices of female students. So at baseline, for the very good female students in math, about 25% were going into STEM fields.
Mm-hmm.
For boys with the same type of math results, It was much higher, 40%. Right. So big gap, 25% versus 40%. That gap is almost entirely closed after this 1 hour or so presentation by a female scientist.
Wow.
This comes with caveats, which is that the female scientist has to talk about her career, but not be too transparent about the difficulties that she may have encountered as a woman in
kind of sugarcoat it a little bit.
Right. The effect was much stronger with a bit less transparency. What I found surprising was that the effect was really, really big. So that really shows it's about embodying the career rather than just informing the students that this is a possible path.
So inspiration from role models is huge.
Inspiration from role models that you can really empathize with, identify with. And in the US, there's been a relatively similar study, but for superstars in math. So they look at high school students who take some of the hardest math competition in the country. And they find that at baseline, girls, even how they're very, very good, and even them are not so likely to pursue in STEM fields later on at university. But when you bring in mentors, you can again change that quite quickly. So that's a hopeful message, suggesting that if we can massify this, that can have a big potential to change the composition of the next generation of engineers and inventors.
Hmm. I would have imagined that today, because of the internet, because of apps, for example, that this would have opened up the possibility of a lot more innovation, you know, all over the world in a way that would not have been so easy, perhaps even 30 years ago, where everything is much more mechanical.
Yes, I mean, you're right that it gets easier to code. You can use generative AI to help you code. And then you can create these apps in a relatively simple way, but you still have barriers. For instance, we do have information on phone applications, so we can see all the founders, and you still see very big disparities, including by gender. I think a lot of that has to do with sociological factors that are very widespread and don't change that much, even with new technologies. So even though maybe the reality is that it's easier than it was in the past, people might still think this is not for them. It's not just not part of who they are. When we ask people why they went into STEM fields, they often talk about mentors, they often talk about the role of family, but they also talk about hobbies. And so this makes me think of your question, because sometimes boys play video games and then they get interested in like creating their own video game, and then in this way they start coding. So then they can take that skill and apply it to other topics. And that tends to happen less for girls. And so this role of hobbies during childhood is also one important thing to keep in mind. And certainly at school, we can try to offset that by directly giving coding courses. And so then everyone has the skills and then everyone might feel empowered to explore these things by themselves.
Are there any countries out there that are doing a better job of this and recognize that they could get a lot out of trying to increase the diversity of their innovators?
Some countries do better. For example, Estonia is much more gender balanced.
In terms of its innovators?
In terms of innovators, and especially among software engineers. That's one of the very, very few examples. I mean, I think it's gaining traction slowly. I think the main hurdle is that people, I think, haven't realized the power of these policies in the long run. And I think even in the short run, they can be very powerful, because if you target high school students, within 5 years, you can have really changed the landscape of the new graduates and have much more talent in startups. There are some studies that show that within 5 years, you can get pretty big effects. And so I think that's probably what policymakers haven't fully grasped. I think we should get there. And the first country that does this, I think, will have big gains for the country itself, but might also inspire other countries to then follow suit.
Hmm. There's a lot to think about there. Xavier Jaravel, I thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. And I hope we hear more about your work in the future.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Xavier Jaravel is a professor of economics at the London School of Economics. He was speaking with Rhoda Metcalf. Look for his article, Innovation's Unseen Frontier, in the March issue of Finance and Development magazine at imf.org/FND. And look for more IMF podcasts on the platform of your choice. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.